Accession number 34702, reel 5.
Denham, reel 5. So, Eric, you were just telling me about the Miles Martinet as an aircraft?
Yes. As you probably know, it's a variant of the Master, which was a training aircraft. The controls were removed from the back and a winch, electric winch is fitted, which is used for towing or streaming the drogues, which were used as targets by an ensign flying below and weaving about to simulate the movement of the drogue as an aircraft attacking the rear of the ensign. Bullets were tipped with paint for each student so that it could be seen whether they hit the target, and if so, how many rounds it hit the target, which were very few, really. And then the drogue was dropped onto the airfield and picked up on by the ground crew and assessed.
Were there any hazards in obviously flying with a drogue attached?
Not really. I can't remember any real problems we had with entanglements or anything like that. It had a fixed tail wheel, of course, but it didn't cause any problems, to my knowledge. And I didn't know of any incidents where bullets went in the wrong direction either.
And how did it handle as an aircraft?
It handled quite well, yes. The TTOs, towed target operators, were all airmen, who I think were given a small amount of flying pay to do the job. And then later on, as more and more aircrew became available, particularly air gunners, as the bomber offensive diminished, then they started doing the job to keep them employed, really.
So how long were you there?
I was there till VE Day came along. About that time, we re-equipped for the cine camera work with Spitfire Mark 7, and for conversion onto those, the idea was that we'd do so many sorties in the back seat of the Master again, simulating the long nose of the Spitfire, which of course was the main problem of visibility with the Spitfire, particularly on the ground. And we used the Spitfire S7 then for the cine camera work, still using the Martinet for the live firing stuff. And let me see now, which is...
Can I ask about that, Eric, just a second, though? With the Spitfire, when you convert onto something, obviously it's a single-seater.
Yeah.
So that conversion, you mentioned that you did time in the Master. Is there anything else you have to do?
Yes. Oh, yeah, I had to thoroughly read the pilot's notes, be questioned and examined on the emergency procedures, that sort of thing, and... So then a certificate was signed, I think, saying, you know, you were competent, and off you went. Now, most Spitfire pilots will tell you, Spitfire taking off is quite an art. Because it's a powerful single-engine propeller engine, you have a tremendous amount of torque on the runway, and then so you have to put on full rudder. As you get airborne, you have to change hands, take your right hand off the control because that was on for takeoff and the left hand was on the throttle. Take the control with the left hand, operate the undercarriage, which is a rather complicated arrangement. Came out of a gate, then selected up and then back into a gate, and that was it. At the same time then, you needed to close your hood, which had been left open for takeoff. So it's quite a sight to see somebody take it off first time, because they seem to buck up and down and go sideways all over the place. But you gradually got used to that sequence of events.
So the first time you actually fly it, though, you're on your own, aren't you?
Oh, yes. There were no dual aircraft in those days, of course, in Spitfires. They've modified some these days. And that was quite something pleasurable for us to get an aircraft that, you know, like the Spitfire, which is an iconic machine, of course, and be able to fly it.
How did it handle in comparison with the other aircraft that you'd flown until that point?
Much the same. It was quite an easy airplane to fly in that respect. It was more of a trouble on the ground because of the taxiing and also overheating. You sometimes had to operate the flap manually to get more air in to try and cool it down, so you didn't want to be hanging around on the ground waiting for takeoff. You need to be able to start up, taxi out and go straight off.
And with the taxiing, was there a technique to taxiing
it? Yes, you just wandered from side, put the nose from side to side and wandered down the taxiways like that, so you could see out to the left and see out to the right.
I have heard people mention that they felt it was slightly cramped in the cockpit. Would that be something that
it was? Yes, it was. There wasn't a lot of a spare room in the cockpit, but most of us were fairly slim young chaps in those days. And I don't know of any restrictions on height or anything like that for the hood.
So that was used for the cine camera work then?
Yes.
Well, what did that involve with the Spitfire?
Well, we were an attacking aircraft for the gunners in the Anson, in the mid-upper turret, and they had cine camera guns in there, so that we would do various types of attack, high quarters, low quarters, sort of thing, and then each one's film would be analysed after the sortie. As to the possibility of obtaining any hits. So that was fairly routine work, as was the towing, of course.
So that period of time, though, I assume that you were building up quite a lot of hours, were you, in you?
Well, quite a lot of sorties of short duration. I mean, the most of the sorties were under an hour, 55 minutes or an hour, something like that. But we would do perhaps four or five a day, yes.
So, in a sense, are you at that stage getting used to just, in a sense, flying a lot of aircraft?
Yes.
What was the next stage for you, Eric, then, once when you were there? Because you said you were there on VE Day.
That's right, and then later on, in November 1945, the station closed down because it was at the end of the war in Europe. And I was posted to Andreas on the Isle of Man, doing exactly the same job. Most of us were spread around the other air gunnery schools. And Andreas was a wartime built station, which was dispersed sites, living sites, that sort of thing. Well, on our site, where we lived in Nisnuts, so beer was easier to get than water, because we had a pub just across the road. And in the morning we had to go up to the main site to get a shower or a bath or wash and shave and all this. On arrival, you were issued with a bicycle. And that was the most important thing in your life. Because, as you can imagine, there were no ways of locking them up and that sort of thing. So you got to the mess, left it outside. Somebody was short of a bike, you come out and yours had gone. So you had to borrow somebody else's to get to where you wanted to go. So bicycles were very important items on these dispersed sites.
And was it the same? Was it still the same air gunnery school?
Yes, it was another air gunnery school, 11 AGS. And we had the Spitfire 16s there, a later mark. And
how did they differ? Was there much of a difference?
It was the Spitfire 16 was a engine by a Packard built Merlin in America. We used to swear that the engines didn't sound as good as the Rolls-Royce ones, but whether that was just our own prejudice, I don't know.
So I take it there wasn't much problem with performance or any differences
No. They were better. There was a better an operated engine as far as that goes. And we had same sort of thing there. One particular thing we had to do every day, there was a duty Spitfire pilot who got up early, took the aircraft down to Ronald's Way, Douglas Airport, to get the Met forecast, because we didn't have a Met man on the station. You would fly down to Ronald's Way, land, taxi around to the tower, they'd give you the forecast, you'd go back to Andrews, hand it over, and that would be the basis of the day's briefing then, for what flying was going to be performed.
So when that happened, with your day's briefing, do they allocate everybody to a specific task at that point? Is that when you find out what you're doing?
Well, yes. That after the general briefing, it would be decided whether the weather was fit to the particular exercises, and then the squadron, our own squadron, would allocate the various trips throughout the day, which was the cine camera work, as before.
And did you need sort of specific weather conditions, if you would? I'm thinking with the cine camera work, I imagine you need relatively good vision, don't you?
You need fairly good weather, yes.
How easy was that over that period? Because you went there in November, didn't you? Into into the middle of the Irish Sea. So I was wondering.
Yeah, that's right.
If you got many days where you could do.
I think the crossing the Irish Sea in the Isle of Man steam packet was probably worse than most of the other problems we had. I say the living conditions were probably the more primitive, and I think after a certain, how long it was, they closed it down and we moved over to Jerby, which was a more permanent RAF station on the Isle of Man.
So the first station you were on then, is that, you said it was wartime, does that mean there were no real facilities other than what had been built during the war?
Yes. The airfield had been built, and then the living quarters had been dispersed around, as was normal in those days, of course, to minimise any damage should they be bombed.
And was Jerby more permanent then?
Yes. Just try to see when it was. Yes, that's. I changed jobs there. I converted onto the Wellington.
At Jerby?
Yes.
So what did that involve then, with the conversion onto a Wellington? How did you go about
the Wellington was being used then for the air gunners, rather than the Anson, which had been dropped, and just used to fly around with these students in the back and the instructors, and the Spitfires would do the cine camera attacks, etc.
So you converted onto a Wellington, though, because of course that's multi-engined again, yeah, isn't it? And I know you'd flown multi-engine before, but was there a sort of conversion period that you had to participate in?
No, it was done on...
Paused it on there. Sorry, you were about to say.
Yes, the conversion was just done by QFI on the unit.
So it was all done on the station,
was it? On the station, yes. In those days, things were a bit more relaxed in that respect.
And I take it by this stage, with your experience of flying, am I right in thinking a lot of the sort of... You know, the basic technicalities of flying are there with you, really, and it's only knowing about specific elements of the aircraft that you need to know.
That's right, yes. Pilot's notes and periodic checks. Not in a proper way that happened later on when things settled down. Things were a bit ad hoc.
Is that a hangover from the war period?
Yes, yes.
Tell me about the Wellington then, Eric. What was that like as an aircraft? Because again, it's another iconic aircraft, isn't it, though?
Yes. It was a nice aeroplane to fly with the Wellington, yes. And these are Wellington Mark 10, so they're quite later models, I suppose. And we did the cine camera work, as I say, and we did their gunnery as such as well, air-to-ground gunnery and things like that.
So would the air gunners sit in the Wellington?
Yes, and then they go into the rear turret in turn, and they'd be an instructor.
Am I right in thinking that the Wellington had a fairly unique construction?
It was a geodetic construction, it was Barnes-Wallis invention, and as I say, geodetic construction, and then covered in fabric, and I mean, from operational point of view, it had done pretty well, actually. It had survived some quite nasty beat-ups and got back to base.
What was it powered by, the Mark 10?
The Pegasus engines, I think, weren't they? Something like that. No, Hercules engines, sorry. Hercules 16.
And was it steady and reliable as aircraft go?
Oh, yes, yes. Yes. Didn't have any problems that I can recall, no. No. While we were there, we used to go off on the odd course, and I see here I went on to the number one Beaver approach school at Watchfield, which is now a housing estate, I think, where it was, we were back to the Oxford again, and we were using the Beaver approach system that I mentioned before, I think, didn't you? And it was run by a civilian outfit, I forget the name of them. But I did that course two or three times because nobody particularly wanted to go, so I didn't mind it.
Was it, in a sense, they were finding things for you to do at that stage? Because I'm wondering what your, you know, what your position was at that point, because you'd volunteered, hadn't you, for air crew?
Yeah.
Initially. So, you know, we've come to the end of the war.
Yeah.
What was your status?
This was about the time when a lot of aircrew were being made redundant and leaving the service anyway, or having to remuster if they weren't commissioned. And the same was happening in commissioned officers as well. They were having to go down several ranks and that sort of thing. And I applied to for a long service career. I was a warrant officer by then. I went to Padgate and was interviewed, and sworn in again, and ostensibly will be serving for 22 years. Hopefully, as far as I knew, flying, which is what I wanted to do. That's why I was staying in the Air Force, to keep flying. That was very difficult to achieve in some cases, because obviously there were a lot of pilots around who had been trained and now were not required. So the competition was a bit fierce.
And is it a case that people were worrying if they went away from flying that they might not get back into it?
Yes, yes. A lot were encouraged to remuster to other trades. And quite a lot did. And of course an awful lot went out. It only stayed in for the duration of the war. So things were beginning to sort of settle down after the war. But then they had to come, well, I'll come to it later on, to a reorganisation of where all these hundreds and hundreds of warrant officers there, the air crew, they had to be demoted, really, but in a way that appeared that they weren't being demoted. This happened when later on, when I was at Leckenfield.
So what was the next stage for you? Obviously, you'd been at on Derby. When did you make a move from there?
Then. I think my next... After Derby, yes. I was posted to number one FTS at Spitalgate, near Grantham, to be the unit test pilot. Now this was a standard FTS equipped with Tiger Moths and Harvards, and they needed somebody to air test aircraft when they'd come in for major and minor servicing and rectification. So I was attached to the engineering wing, although for flying, of course, I came under the flying side of things. And each day I would be told, we've got, say, two Tiger Moths and three Harvards that need air testing, and I'd get on and do it. I always had a lot of volunteers who wanted to come and fly with me, or ex-air crew as well, so anything to get out of what they were doing. So
So when you air test an aircraft, then what does that involve? What would you do to test it?
Well, just fly it around really, and carry out a couple of approaches and landing, do a bit of stalling or something like that, a spin maybe, and just see that everything seems to be working all right. And then if found any snags, obviously report them, and then they would check them again, and then those aircraft would be released to the instructional side for instructional purposes.
Did you find at that stage, when you were sort of there testing the aircraft, there were certain specific aircraft that would maybe always have the same snags?
No, I don't recall anything like that. No, the worst thing about they're testing the Tiger Moth in the open cockpit, of course, in the weather. So they tend to be fairly short.
So you would in a sense there, are you almost in a sense slightly independent in
yes.
that role from
yes,
the stage?
Yes, I am. Yes, I was on the engineering wing as the test pilot there. I hadn't had any training as a test pilot because it was necessary for that sort of job. But of course, anything to do with flying, I had to be under the control of the wing commander flying. Though in fact, it was my aunt's brother. And he was a wing commander then. He was a sergeant pilot before the war, I think. He's always been in instructing. Which, I was a warrant officer. He was a wing commander. But, I mean, well, I didn't have any real clashes with them.
So, essentially, you more or less left up to get on with your own day.
As long as I got on and organised the air tests and did them, that was it. That didn't last very long.
When did you go there?
I went there in November 1947 and left in March 1948 because the unit was moving, I think, to Syston. And for some reason or other, I wasn't to go with them. I was posted to Central Gunnery School at Leckenfield in Yorkshire, near Beverley. That was a mixed sort of station consisting of the main side of it was for the fighter pilot side of it. We had people like Teddy Donaldson and all sorts of people, and his brother, and quite a few of the Battle of Britain people there, and I think they were crippling mosquitoes initially, but that side of it was nothing to do with me. On our side, we trained air gunnery instructors. So we gone to the instructor's side of it there. And we were equipped with, we had the Lancaster, Mark 7 Lancaster. Yeah.